talk about the built environment as well, and so some of the material that I'm going to be presenting overlaps a little bit with you've heard from some of the presentations, particularly John Balbus channeling Larry Frank here. So I'll skip over a little bit of that. The first thing I'll say is Smart Growth America is our organization. That is our website. Please visit it. A lot of the resources I'm going to be referring to are posted here. It's smartgrowthamerica.org. One of the things, the main thing that I'm going to be presenting is a new study that we just produced called Growing Cooler. It is a joint effort. Lead author is a guy named Reed Ewing, who's a professor at the University of Maryland. I'm a co-author, Steve Winkleman, whose work Larry cites and I cite and everybody in the world cites, is another co-author. There's a couple other folks who contributed to it. And it is very focused on what we heard described as the three-legged stool, the transportation sector greenhouse gas emissions that come from issues like vehicle inefficiency or efficiency, if you will, the greenhouse gas content of fuels, as well as vehicle miles traveled. This is a giant slice of the total climate equation. It's also a growing one. And one of the lessons that we kind of in the climate field have learned for over the last number of years is that there's really no easy ton of reduction. Everything is going to be pretty challenging, so we have to pay attention to all these different aspects. I'm going to skip over this because you saw something quite similar. This is, again, Steve Winkleman's charts, but basically the point is we can't ignore vehicle miles traveled. They've been growing at a tremendous rate. So the research that we did in this new book, Growing Cooler, was really targeting these questions about VMT. Number one, what is the reduction in VMT that is possible in the United States through compact development or smart growth rather than pursuing continued urban sprawl? That's the first big question. The second question was what reduction in CO2 emissions can we get from reductions in vehicle miles traveled? And then the third one is what policy changes will be required to get us there? And a sub-question within that last one is, do Americans want compact development? I'm going to be addressing those questions here. In order to do this study, we looked at four literatures. We looked at aggregate travel studies, disaggregate travel studies, regional simulation studies, and project simulation studies. If you really want to read the study and get a hold of it, you can go to our website. It's close to the top of the main page, and again, the study's called Growing Cooler, but I'm not actually going to go into great detail here in describing this. Instead, I'm going to talk about more of the results that we came up with, and then more of the how, the tools of the policy tools and other things. But one of the things that we discovered, one of the conclusions after looking through all of that literature, there were like over 130 studies from all over the world to look at. We found that changes in the built environment can result in dramatic reductions in vehicle miles traveled. And generally speaking, it's from things like densification, design, diversity of uses, destination accessibility within regions, and those types of things. People often refer to those as the four Ds. So those factors, if you put them all together, if you have a scenario like what you were describing earlier, John, where you have a relatively compact area that has public transportation and mixed uses and places to walk to and sidewalks and things like that, you will see a dramatic reduction in VMT compared with places that are very sprawling and automobile dependent. Not a big earth-shattering surprise, but the literature reveals that we can see a reduction in VMT by about a third if all those elements are put together, and there are places all over the world where you can see that on the ground. Now, that translates into, if you think about the transport sector, the entire transport sector, the CO2 emissions within that, if you have reductions of VMT and you gradually, build communities more compactly over the next generation, out to 2030, which is the timeline that we looked at in our study, then within that period of time you can see a decrease of about 7 to 10% in total CO2 emissions from the transport sector. Seems like a modest number, but again, there's no easy ton of reduction in the climate change world. And again, this is only reductions that are related to land development effects. It transportation sector, and they're essentially permanent. So the more compact developments we're able to see, such as what's predicted in Chris Nelson's research that John cited, the more development you have, the more you lock in those lower VMT levels. Versus if you continue to have sprawl, you lock in travel behavior patterns that are automobile dependent and generate more and more greenhouse gas emissions. So that is the main finding from the study. And in terms of equivalency, it's about equal to a 28% increase in CAFE standards to 32 miles per gallon by 2020. That's very similar to the Senate bill. If any of you follow politics and climate change legislation, the Senate bill proposes something quite similar. It's 35 miles per gallon by that timetable. And so, we're talking about a pretty significant reduction in CO2 emissions. And so the message that we like to convey to people is, living in a convenient neighborhood, compact development, place with lots of choices, place to walk and public transit and things like that, can reduce CO2 emissions as much as driving a hybrid, and they're even better together. Something that people need to think about as they make their choices as they go through life. Now, I'll reiterate the point that this really is just from land development, changes in land development and the built environment. Our study did not look at gains from changes in pricing. For example, if you increase taxes on gasoline, or if you price the roadways, or if you institute congestion pricing like what Mayor Bloomberg is trying to do in New York City, or if you increase the cost of parking, or you do pay-as-you-go insurance, any of those pricing strategies are not reflected here. So they could have a synergistic effect with the built environment. It could potentially generate much bigger reductions in travel behavior. It also does not reflect gains that you might see from just providing more travel options. So if any of you saw Parade magazine this weekend, they talked about Amtrak and the fact that rail in America is really crippled by the lack of funding and the lack of coordination, etc. And so if there is more funding and just a greater rail travel system in the United States, then we could have more options there. And then finally, this is an important point that a lot of people miss when they're thinking about transportation CO2 emissions. When you're talking about land development, you're actually really disrupting a tremendous, the Earth's ability to retain, carbon. And so when we deforest areas, when we convert forested areas to agriculture or agriculture to asphalt, then you're also eliminating the land's ability to absorb that much more of the carbon that we're talking about. And so that's another major impact that is often overlooked. And it's one that my friends in the forestry field and other areas really focus on. So all of this is contained in our study. Please have a look at it. It's actually going to be published as a book by the Urban Land Institute, which is a little man-bites-dog thing, because they're actually the think tank for big developers. So they feel a responsibility to try to get into this game, the climate change debate, by publishing, books and reports on this topic. So I encourage you to get a hard copy when it comes out in January. You must all be thinking the same thing right now. You must all be thinking, this is all nice and everything, but Americans love to drive, and we all live in the suburbs, and so there's no chance in hell that this is going to change. So the question is, is it going to happen? Do Americans want compact development? The interesting thing, and this is something that we've been learning steadily over the last many years, is that there is actually a huge amount of change afoot right now in terms of consumer preferences, in terms of what's being built on the ground today. There are dozens of studies out there that have looked at development trends and changes in consumer preferences with regard to what type of home people would like to live in the future. One of the most authoritative sources is a company called Robert Charles Lesser & Company. They're one of the nation's largest real estate valuation and advisory firms out there. And what they've done in the last few years is they've done studies for big developers or realtors other builders in different metropolitan markets during the last several years. This is from a guy named Greg Logan, who's their managing director. He cites 12 studies done in the last several years all over the country. You can see the different cities listed. They're very diverse, some urban locations, some suburban locations. And if you see, all these different places, They have consistently found that one-third of respondents to their surveys prefer new urbanism and smart growth housing products. In other words, places that are compact, walkable, mixed use. It's an astounding factor if you know, it bucks against conventional wisdom. And the other interesting thing about all this is that we're finding that not only do we see one-third of the market really demanding this, but it's for a lot of reasons that a lot of people haven't really considered. Things like demographic trends, things like changing buyer preferences and lifestyle changes. And a lot of it is manifested in the fact that people are starting to really command, demand different types of homes. New urbanist homes, for example, the compact walkable type. This is Kentlands and Lakelands are located very close to where we are right now. They command a premium at the marketplace, and they tend to hold that price premium over time, not because they're fancier or because they're inherently more expensive. It's because they're in very high demand, and as a result, people are willing to pay much more money for them. And another factor that we've seen is that a lot of companies are now starting to develop brands. They're spending millions of dollars developing brands for urban development. So you have the high pros, the high production builders, developing brands like Centex. Centex Homes has City Homes. K. Havnanian has Metro Living. There's KB Urban, City Living. These are all new brands coming out primarily because people are starting to change their home buying preferences. And the biggest reason for this is because of demographics. I think everyone here has heard about how baby boomers are, hitting retirement age. This is just a simple chart that I got from Chris Nelson from Virginia Tech showing, how many people are turning 65 annually. And you see this gigantic spike right around 2010, 2011, 2013, 12, thereabouts. And if you rewind 65 years from that period, you'll see we're in 1946, 1947, right at the beginning of the baby boom era, and it's sustained for quite a long time. That has led to a number of different factors in our demographics. You can see back in 1960, during the heyday of the baby boom era, we had about half the households with children. And if you look at today, we have today is about a third. 2025, just barely over a quarter of households are going to have kids. So it's a dramatic change in demographics. It has implications for the housing market that are really very different from what we hold in terms of conventional wisdom. The number of households without kids is much bigger. So the demand for different types of households, again, is changing. We see today's supply, if you look at the yellow bar, large lot single family homes, we have a lot of that. In terms of the purple bar in the middle or the red bar, the small lot homes, we don't have as big a supply. In terms of the attached homes, like townhouses, condos, things like that, that's kind of the bluish, purplish bar to the left. We also don't have a very big supply of that relative to single-family large lot homes. But in 2025, that dynamic's going to change very much. The demand for the columns to the left is going to go way up, and so the number of new units needed to meet that demand is also going to go way up again for attached homes as well as small lot homes, and the net new units needed for large lot single family is actually negative. We already have the amount of single family large lot homes that we're going to need in about 15 or 20 years. The argument is that we should stop building all those, build more compact attached housing in order to meet market demand. So that is a body of research that is really emerging. It's becoming very powerful and strong within the marketplace. The other area that's really growing is the growing demand for transit-oriented development. We're seeing that there's a study from Reconnecting America and a bunch of other sources that find that people are really getting sick and tired of traffic congestion, and they're really finding much more appealing the ability to live near convenient transportation options like by a rail station or by a bus corridor or those types of things. So the demand is growing tremendously. Ridership in transit systems is also really growing quite a bit. In the last number of years, there's been a number of new systems established, and almost all of them are exceeding their ridership expectations, which is just great news in terms of our ability to potentially fight climate change with this strategy. And then just over a week ago, we released a new poll with the National Association of Realtors, and we're finding, and we've done polling, we've done many polls over the last decade, we're finding that not only have people really changed their consumer preferences in terms of the types of places they'd like to live in, but they're also changing their attitudes about public policy and how you know, people should respond, how our public officials should respond to these challenges. So when they're thinking about traffic and they're thinking about solutions to traffic congestion and gridlock, you know, most Americans are favoring strategies like improving public transportation and developing communities where people don't have to drive as much. Much more of that as opposed to favoring building new roads. We're also seeing that there's a lot of you know, kind of embrace of transit and walkable communities as solutions to climate change. And this is actually a new question that's never been asked before until, you know, the Realtors and Smart Growth America put this poll together. And then finally, you know, just to reinforce some messages that we've, you know, been polling on over the last decade or so, we're still seeing a lot of very strong support, 81% in this case, for people, you know, for the idea that we should, you know, in order to accommodate new growth in America, we should redevelop existing places, do infill, brownfields redevelopment, reclaim our abandoned properties, as opposed to building new developments in greenfields and continue to build urban sprawl. So that is a big challenge for us. Okay, I'm just going to skip over this. Last section I'm going to talk about is the policies. Growing Cooler has four recommendations. We talk about following: setting targets to get states and localities to show, you know, basically set targets and then they can show us how to achieve them. The second one is really investing in transportation choices. The third one is basically helping communities rewrite the rules. And this goes to your question about zoning and, you know, the codes and all the planning rules that people have to abide by when they're developing communities. And then the last one is creating positive incentives and eliminating perverse incentives that exist today that point us in the direction towards urban sprawl. The setting targets thing is pretty straightforward. The Supreme Court recently affirmed EPA's authority to regulate CO2 emissions and other greenhouse gas emissions on the Clean Air Act. And so that is something that, you know, we're still waiting for, but we know that the authority is there. And so there are a bunch of ideas that we're pursuing through a variety of means. You know, one is the idea of transportation air quality conformity, which was established in NICE-T, the Intermodal Surface Transportation Efficiency Act of 1991. We would, you know, the idea would be to extend that to CO2 emissions, not just other criteria pollutants. The other ideas are things like setting targets within state climate action plans. I'm sure you've heard a lot about those recently in the last couple of days. And then local plans. You probably all know that last week the mayors from all over the country got together, talked about climate. The big headline in the New York Times article about it was walkable communities, public transportation, you know, green buildings. I mean, the built environment figured prominently because mayors are also, you know, very, very focused on redevelopment and community development. So that's absolutely critical. In terms of investing in choices, you know, Safety Lou, which is the big federal transportation bill, over $300 billion, that is going to be reauthorized in a couple of years. We want to make that into something that we're calling Green T. We want it to be truly a green transportation bill, have it focus on, you know, more than just building highways and have it tied to climate change goals. Fortunately, the chairman of the committee, Barbara Boxer, who's the chairman of chairwoman of Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, has said that she wants to make this environmental bill. And then another idea is to really direct funding directly to metropolitan areas rather than just give the money over to metropolitan, rather to state departments of transportation, which have been the culprits in the past in terms of just allowing the funding to go towards more highways. I'm going to go through just like two or three examples really quick. You know, I know we're running out of time here. Arlington, Virginia is a great place to go to. They've really densified development along the Orange Line corridor. If you ever have a chance to go, it's an absolutely delightful place. They've managed to do this without disturbing the surrounding neighborhoods, and as a result, have generated incredible results in terms of people, you know, walking to train stations, the high percentage of people who take transit within that corridor, and other fiscal benefits for that region. We're also sitting right in the middle of one of the success stories in terms of turning around part of a city. This is a little outdated. This should say the Verizon Center instead of MCI. But we're very close to where that red dot is, where the train station is, the transit station. But this has been a great success story in terms of reinvesting in a place close to transit and doing it in such a way that really has caused a tremendous amount of infill development in a very small amount of land. You can see the little red circle there. That's the area we're talking about, a quarter-mile radius around the train station. And the development outcomes, land use outcomes, have been huge. 4.7 million square feet of office, retail, hotel, and entertainment. And again, this is an old slide, so the numbers are even bigger now. You know, over $1.5 billion of investment, a lot of housing units. And if you take that type of development, scale of development, stick it in Loudoun County, Virginia, which is a commuter suburb for D.C., and a lovely area in its own right for its rural character, at its prevailing densities for, you know, office, retail, hotel, and entertainment, they would have chewed up 1,300 acres. And if any of you are from here, that's a huge amount of land. That's what it looks like compared to where we've had our redevelopment here in Gallery Place. Last thing I'm going to mention, perverse incentives and eliminating them and creating new incentives. Federal, state, and local, there's an awful lot there. Okay. Oh, thanks. I'd say the conventional challenge is that we still have a lot of legacy transit stations that are kind of the old mold. They're kind of transit without development. If you're living in a development here, you have to actually get in a car and drive on the highway to get to your train station. It's really what we call automobile-oriented transit, and a lot of that is it's now regarded as this is more kind of transit for engineers. You know, how do you get the maximum number of people in and out of a city as opposed to creating a place? And so that is a real big challenge for us in terms of overcoming the barrier. And then the last thing, technical know-how and capacity. We do have a need to rewrite the rules. Very often planning agencies just don't have the capacity, may not have the know-how to do, you know, fancy things like visioning. Helping people imagine what their conventional streetscape can look like if they undergo a number of changes. Things like street trees, different codes for sidewalks and parking, a whole variety of other changes. Non-policy strategies, citizens can do a lot. They can support good development. Developers can also get in the act. Urban Land Institute has done a lot of that to support smart growth. And the government can do things that are non-governmental. They can actually encourage people to discuss the challenges and Choose Our Community's Future is a book that we produced, and really do more education and engagement of citizens through a variety of different means. I'm gonna speed through this because I've obviously gone over time. Last thing I'll mention to you is just a reminder, the very last thing. You want to go to Growing Cooler, you want to get that, go to our website and feel free to download it, and it's available from the Urban Land Institute in January. Thanks.
According to my watch, we still have about 2 minutes for questions, so I'm going to invite John and Eva down, and we'll have them up front and take any questions that we have. And until somebody picks us out, because we got it. Why don't you guys come sit up at the panel?
Okay. It's true that a huge proportion of trips are not work trips. In fact, as we see the baby boom generation getting older, people actually increase their driving after they retire because they're going off to social engagements and you know, their friends may live in a pretty dispersed way. And so that's one of the challenges that we need to address. But one of the consistent findings that we found through the process of doing Growing Cooler is that VMT actually reduces for all types of purposes, whether it's social, getting food, you know, going to your job, you know, all those types of things tend to decrease if you have, you know, compact development, good design, diversity, and destination accessibility.
This morning it was mentioned that there's a huge amount of money in the carbon trading economy that you're seeing in Europe and the United States. Smart growth is doing great things. Are you going to be able to tap into that money before their own companies get it?
You know, one of our proposals in the book is to say, you know, we should take a chunk of that money and invest it in things like urban infrastructure, reinvestments. You know, for example, one of the big challenges that a lot of our cities face is that we have crumbling infrastructure. We've got the CSO issue. You know, that warrants some infrastructure upgrades. We also have exploding steam pipes in New York. We got crumbling bridges in Minnesota. It's all over the place. And so reinvestment will help us get there. Now, there is a real kind of difference of opinion and strategy forming in the climate world among environmentalists. So those who believe that, you know, regulation will kind of primarily be the path, and then those who think investment will primarily be the path. And if any of you have read the new book Breakthrough by the kind of the bad boys of the environmental world, Schellenberg and Nordhaus, they make this distinction. And I think it's very valuable to have both perspectives in the investment part of it. Investing, you know, in things that will pollute less is the way to go. Pay dividends in the future, not just in terms of climate, but in terms of, you know, society.
Yes?
What happens to all that investment that you've made all of this sort of
market? Well, you know, a lot of places are already starting to become more compact on a kind of a localized level. And so a lot of places are being retrofitted. You know, for example, a lot of suburban shopping malls are being converted into neighborhoods. They're scraping the mall off the surface, and then they're building neighborhoods in their place, call them gray fields. A lot of places that didn't have good street connectivity are being reconnected. They're adding streets and alleys to those types of areas. So there's a real opportunity to take advantage of the fact that you have existing infrastructure, and those can be redesigned to look better. A great example is Addison Circle in Dallas, Texas. It's kind of a conventional, you know, office park that has been completely, you know, changed around to be a much more walkable and compact environment.
Last question.
Yeah, that's a very good point. About 4 years ago, 3 years ago, we did a study called the Health Impacts of Sprawl, and it was really the first study of its kind, linking, you know, the first big national study linking urban form and a number of different health indicators, you know, and chronic disease as well. So primarily, we're looking at BMI as well as things like diabetes and hypertension, and the relationship that we found there. Was that in places that are, you know, relatively compact, and we were looking at, you know, counties for that particular study, places that are relatively compact, you know, had a six-pound difference in terms of people versus places that were relatively sprawling. So, you know, very dramatic difference. It was published in the American Journal of Health Promotion. We also orchestrated this co-release between that journal and the American Journal of Public Health to kind of release their feature issues on the built environment and walking and obesity together on the same day. So all the stuff that I've talked about, you know, because because walking and cycling and those types of things are part of such an important part of Growing Cooler, they really, all those goals go hand in hand.
Thank you very much, everybody.